Lady Ryder, reel two.
I suppose if the Slovak and Czech sections had been bigger, then it might have been quite a different story. And one must never forget the numbers of people who were arrested. They didn't live under the horror of being divided up by the Soviets and the Germans. Their history, as you know so much better than I, had been completely different. But they were very democratic and one of the most forward-looking countries before the war, with a very high standard of education and culture, and I would have thought far less poverty there than though I wasn't. My brother was there in the British Council, but I, from what I knew about them, I think they had a far higher standard of living than the Poles had for many, many reasons. They too had a foreboding of what was going to happen. They thought they would be sold out because they'd already been sold out by us in 1938. Probably, but I have to be cautious because though I knew several of the Czechs who were in the London government and went back afterwards only to be arrested and imprisoned. And those, the few that I knew, came out alive, or several of them did, but they're dead now. But they said that they began to see that the situation was quite hopeless. It didn't mean to say they weren't going to fight. And I was, just digressing again, in Czechoslovakia in 1948 and again in 1968, shortly after the Russians came in. And I was amazed by the resistance then. And we all say, on looking back on hindsight, it would have been better to have fought rather than be in a prison, as they are today.
But your own personal preference was for the Poles, was it?
I had a great regard for the Czechs and the Slovaks, but temperamentally they were very different. As I said, they had a much more sort of solid, plodding kind of outlook, whereas the Poles were, I mean, they were like corks really, because the worse the situation, so they came up for more kind of thing.
How did the British people receive the Czechs and the Poles during the war, from your own personal observation?
I don't know, because we were not, I mean, we were just hidden in stations.
It sounds as though you were leading a very secluded life.
Yes, we were. I mean, we weren't supposed to go out, except on exercises or to take them to a specific place for training. And we only drove them from the op stations to places like Stradishall, the airfield, and then more latterly Thamesford in Bedfordshire. Otherwise, we didn't mix with anybody and we weren't allowed to. I think, from what the Poles told us from before they joined SOE or had been picked, that they were well received by the Scots in Scotland. They were liked by them and they liked Scots. We never heard anything against the British, only except against the politicians, which was understandable.
You said earlier that you had this short period working for the Czech section. For the rest of your time in SOE, was it solely with the Polish section?
Yes.
When you were in one particular country section like that, would you have any contact at all with people in other country sections?
No. No, we were divorced from them. We, in Thamesford, there were different changing huts there near the airfield where the Norwegians would sometimes be present at the same time as, for instance, when the Poles or the Czechs arrived. But each nationality kept to its own changing hut, and we were not allowed by security officially to go to the other hut. Occasionally we did, just to see who was there and if we knew them, when they went onto the tarmac to go to board the aircraft, I mean, then we recognised people and realised where they were going. They've destroyed all that. It's rather a great pity, isn't it?
Yes. You talked about the holding stations. What kind of function did they perform?
That's where the agents came to before they went off on their ops. They were chosen as places of considered by security. They were recommended, I think, again, Mr. Spohr would have known much more about it, but they were recommended by the army for places to be requisitioned. Normally, the inhabitants or the occupiers of the house was simply asked to leave, except with brigands, the forging places. And it was because the owner there already knew, I think, General Gubbins, or he had some direct link with SOE. That's why he and his wife were allowed to remain. But otherwise, we just took over. And the only time we went out was to take them to the airfield.
Did you ever meet General Gubbins?
Oh, yes, I knew him quite well. Not, of course, in the war. I mean, we met him with great awe in the war, but afterwards he became a friend and supporter.
What kind of a man was he, personally?
Remarkable fellow. I mean, he... Great powers of leadership, as one would imagine. He'd served with intelligence before the war in Poland. He had a tremendous high regard for the Poles and their courage. And I think he fought for every aircraft that he could, and he was probably highly disliked by people in the War Cabinet and probably people in the Foreign Office. They just couldn't probably stick his guts. And the same with Mr. Spohrberg in a different way, because he was a civilian. But General Gubbins was a professional soldier. At least we were told he was. And he so encouraged those of us who were very young. I mean, he said that he was glad that we were there and that we should be given full responsibility for things. And he also endorsed, as far as I know and believe, that the Poles were to keep to themselves such things as signals and anything else that they thought could be a risk by passing it over.
Was Gubbins well liked by the people in SOE, do you think?
Generally, I should say so. Of course, I can't speak for the other sections, but he was certainly loved by the Poles.
Did you find that there was any rivalry between sections? Did they compete with each other for resources and so on?
I think they were bound to, yes. They were certainly bound to compete with each other for aircraft and arms and for the massive amount of items that they required to fight in the resistance. But we weren't on that side of it. I mean, that was Baker Street battle, really. But we did know that there was a great strain between whoever was head of the Air Force, and they considered the bomber offensive was first and foremost, and no aircraft should be diverted. And SOE's point of view, as far as I know, is a very small cog in this huge wheel, was that we said, well, if you don't divert, then we can't expect to do what you will consider to be invaluable later.
But I was thinking about between the different country sections. Did you ever feel in the Polish section that other country sections were getting more than their due or anything of that
well,
kind?
Well, no, because we had virtually nothing to do with them, I mean, for security. So we hadn't got a clue. I mean, we wouldn't have asked, and we didn't want to know who was in the French section. We'd met a few bods from Belgium in the training stations, but no, that was all absolutely a closed book. Once we stopped, I remember on the way, to Thamesford because we recognised that there were some Dutch boards, and well, they pulled up because the blinds were always drawn down, so they pulled up on a section of the road where we thought it was all right, but we were ticked off afterwards by the security for doing it. We just said goodbye to them.
Was the title SOE actually well known to the people who worked for it?
I don't think so. I don't think we used it in the war. That part of it sort of goes blank on me. But we called Baker Street Baker Street, and what did I call it earlier? Bureau 6 was known. Bureau 6 were the Poles. I can't remember the Czechs. What they had their own name for their headquarters, which we knew, obviously, because we worked with them. But no, I can't remember that SOE was talked about like that.
So you didn't actually know during the war that you were working for SOE?
Oh, yes, we were told by security. But we, you know, that is something which is a sort of blank in my mind. I'm sure they would have made it clear to us when one was being grilled by them.
Presumably you had a good idea at the time the type of work which the agents were actually going to do once they got across to occupied Europe, did you?
Yes. Not all, but some of them.
I think that you eventually left Britain to work for SOE abroad.
Yes.
Can you tell me how that came about?
One of the reasons given was that the aircraft losses were so great. They did become very horrific in going on the route across Denmark. The defences were built up, and so crews and aircraft and bods were lost either on the way out or the way back. Secondly, there was still some vague hope that by getting into Europe, we thought we'd get into Central Europe ahead of the Red Army. But there were, of course, other reasons which we weren't told and which we never asked about. So we were posted to North Africa.
When approximately was that that you went
42,
there?
43. And then from there on, after the invasion of Italy, we went into Italy.
What were conditions like in North Africa and Italy to work in as compared with Britain, from your own personal point of view?
Completely different. I mean, again, we had to be isolated, so we were in a tent or the back of a truck or something, and occasionally in a little villa. In Italy, I was there for the first winter, 43, 44, and Tannin said it was the worst they'd known for 40 years. There were tremendous gales and snow and ice, and it must have been frightful for the army. It was bad enough for us, but it must have been frightful for the people fighting in the line. And madness. I mean, we couldn't understand. I mean, we knew that there had to be some place after Sicily to go to for the Mediterranean operations, but I'm afraid we cursed Churchill. You know, his words afterwards were crawling up the leg of Italy or something, because it was so mad. It was a country so marvellous to defend, and a loss of manpower. I mean, we weren't supposed to have anything to do with the army, but obviously we had friends and news got back, and we were sometimes quite near the line. It seemed to us a devastating operation altogether.
Were you doing the same type of work in the Mediterranean that you were doing in Britain, personally?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Still preparing the agents to... And did you find it in actual practice that, from the point of view of the flights, it was easier to operate from the south?
No, the winter was ghastly. It was icing up, and it was very, very difficult for the crews. I remember them saying how terrible, because they had terrific headwinds to contend with. Perhaps they didn't have the same appalling defences to get through, but they had other hazards which they came to dread.
Such as?
Well, the bad weather, because they had to cross Italy and Hungary.
And the Alps.
Yes, right. And then the time of the Warsaw Rising, which we knew about from before it actually happened. Then they, a South African squadron came to join the special duties flights we were with. But they were almost entirely annihilated from memory. They were expected to drop in daylight supplies to the Home Army. Well, as they were changing sections so rapidly, and the whole city was enveloped in this huge pall of smoke from the fires and the fighting, it was almost impossible for them to drop anything accurately.
What was the morale like in the Polish section during the period of the summer of 44 when you were attempting to give help to the Warsaw Uprising?
I suppose it was a sort of desperate there was a kind of not a false bravado. It was what I call sheer courage, and there was never any questioning that they shouldn't have done it. You would have thought of being a traitor if you'd said that was it a good thing to, I mean, not a good thing, but if it was a wise course of action for Warsaw to rise, because though several of them knew that it was a bloodbath, it wouldn't succeed, the Russians wouldn't move across the Vistula, they nevertheless thought that their honour was at stake, and regardless of what the world would do about them, and they knew jolly well the world wouldn't come to give them anything, it was considered as part of Poland's honour and history to do it.
Did it cross your own mind as to whether it was a wise thing to do?
Yes, I mean, one or two of us discussed it with them and said, you know, this is absolutely ghastly, and we wouldn't have dared say there isn't any hope, but I mean, we said the casualties are going to be so appalling and are so appalling from the very hour that they struck. But the Poles said, no, it's something we've got to go through with, whatever the outcome. And the majority, in fact, I've hardly ever met one Pole who has said that they considered it unwise to do, because it was something that they had to show the world that they were going to rise against the Germans. They knew in their heart of hearts that the Russians wouldn't come near or do anything at all except thwart them. But they thought that was a further evidence to the Allies what the Soviets were up to. But of course it didn't help, did it?
What do you remember about the supplies that were sent from Italy during those days, if anything?
Well, mainly talking to the crews, who were completely exhausted, and it's difficult just to sort of pick up from memory, but odd remarks said to us by the dispatchers and the crews and the boards, well, why the hell don't, isn't the Polish parachute brigade allowed to come? It was before Arnhem, wasn't it? Is this going to be just fought by us and the civilians and the Home Army? Is no one going to come? Because Stalin refused, of course, to allow the planes to land and refuel. I think he allowed, well, it's in my book, he allowed at one time the Americans land. So if you are in a desperate situation and people are still hell-bent on following it through, you don't really question. You just think it's an appalling, like I suppose in the trenches in the First World War, it's an appalling lack of loss of life. But you don't, you may think inwardly about, wonder inwardly about
the wisdom
of it, yeah, that's the word I'm looking for. But outwardly, you wouldn't have questioned it.
Lots of people always accuse the Poles of being anti-Semitic. From your own contact with them during the war, do you have any comments on that kind of accusation?
I think it's on the whole very unfair, and of late there have been films, haven't there, which you've probably seen. If they were anti-Semitic before the war, which I think some were, it was because the Jews were very successful, and perhaps as a minority they irritated the Poles because of their genius and success in trading. But as for what I have seen on those films, I think it was absolutely disgraceful the way they were portrayed, because I like the Israelis, I have a great and very high regard for the Jews, and I cannot understand them not giving any credit at all, not only to the Poles, but anyone in Europe, for the risks that people ran to hide them, because there was a great deal of activity and attempts to do something. I mean, it was a hopeless situation, but there was constantly we knew people who, and there was a whole section of the Polish section that was devoted to trying to hide the Jews and the forging of papers for them. Most of the convents near the ghetto were all involved in hiding the children, and they all knew that they would be annihilated, and indeed those that were found, of course, were annihilated. I have a very good friend, just one example, a very famous architect in Poland who has terrible back. I mean, her discs were totally broken because of the beating from the Gestapo in the ghetto, and they left her for dead. She'd gone in with food and papers, but they didn't know she was a Pole. And countless other people I can think of who hid them and did everything that they possibly could as a sort of wild gesture, not a wild gesture, but a secret gesture to help, but knowing that nobody else was going to do anything at all. And the world just turned their back on them.
What is the name of the lady whose discs were broken?
Skibinska, Professor Skibinska.
Did you personally come across Polish Jews during the war? I think you were going to say that you couldn't remember any Polish Jews.
Yes. Probably they weren't allowed to become agents, because if they were captured, then they would have had an even worse time. But certainly those in Poland who'd been hidden and were smuggled out to the partisans took part in fighting the Germans. I mean, the partisans were in the woods, you know. So they wouldn't have been in the underground so much as the home army, that they'd been joined the partisans. It's a great pity to me that what I call negative sides of the history comes out more than the positive. I mean, there's good and bad in everybody, but that the acts of heroism shown by people in a hopeless situation, really, doesn't emerge, and hasn't, as far as I know. I mean, obviously one very seldom watches any film, but it would be marvellous to make a film of showing the other side of the coin, wouldn't it?
Yes.
And reports were coming out from the beginning of the war as to where the Germans were setting up the extermination camps and what was going on. And that those reports were all made, and the whole construction of the extermination camps were done at great risk to members of the Home Army. So, and friends of mine, you know, hid. There was one who went back to Poland this week. He was taken in the Warsaw Rising with a boy of 14 when he was fighting. But he was in the resistance all through the war, and his parents in the old city of Warsaw hid. Well, they took in 6 Jews to start with until they passed them on to other people. And that went on until the Warsaw Rising. And when he saw that film, or the beginning of it, he just couldn't stand it.
What about the Warsaw Ghetto? Do you recollect any work of the SOE in giving help to the Warsaw Ghetto when they were crushed?
No, I can't recall anything there. Somebody else would have to answer that question.
And
certainly we knew about it because of the signals that were sent out. We were horrified again and felt totally helpless.
The other thing that we always hear about in connection with the Poles and the war in Britain is the Katyn massacre.
Yes.
Was that too early in the war as far as your own work in SOE?
No. It was known that the Soviets had done it.
What did you get to know when you were in SOE about it?
Well, the Soviets had murdered the intelligentsia, about, I think it was 11 or 12,000, wasn't it? Polish officers who they'd taken. So it was talked about.
Well, what stage? Can you remember at what stage it was talked about?
Yes, just after it happened. It was the summer of 42, I think, wasn't it?
I think this is where the controversy lies, about what date it was.
Well, 41, 42. There was never any doubt in people's minds who did it.
Looking back on your work for SOE during the war, from 1987, do you feel it was all worthwhile, what you did?
Well, I hardly did anything. I mean, I was only just had the honour of being with them, but of course it was. I mean, the total, it's immeasurable, really, what their contribution was to the war effort. It can never be counted, and it never will be counted. As General Govan said to me at some point of the war, of course, they'll be dropped, like being in a boat, simply dropped overboard. We expect to squeeze as much as we can out of them, and then we'll drop them. And he was right. He wasn't sarcastic when he said it, but these words came true.
What about the winding up of SOE at the end of the war? How did it come about as far as you were concerned?
Well, I can't tell you that what happened over here, because it was Baker Street. And by that time it had become very much bigger. And we were, in a sense, weren't answerable to Baker Street. We were answerable to the Poles, and we were on our way.